Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Anwar Bukhaz, who is a professor of political science and international studies at McDaniel University, where he researches the impact of transitional liberalization processes on levels of political violence and terrorism in different Middle Eastern contexts. He is the author of the book Politics in Morocco, Executive Monarchy and Enlightened Authoritarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anwar Bukhaz.
Thank you.
The Arab Spring seems to be what seems to unite the people on the streets is that they're all sort of fighting for the same thing. They're young and frustrated, and they feel their futures are being stolen, and the word dignity comes up a lot. But the differences appear to be the extent to which the dictatorships are prepared to be ruthless. And within the dictatorships, you have military dictators and you have monarchies. And then the differences between the approaches of the monarchies are, on the one hand, the Saudi monarchy wants to turn back the clock, make no compromises with the Arab Spring and the future. And the Moroccan king, on the other hand, seems to be a little more enlightened and seems to see the writing on the wall. Would you agree with that analysis?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, first, the regional upheaval we're seeing in the Middle East, I think it was always expected that it would play out in many different ways, in many different contexts. Let's take the Saudi Arabia, for example. I mean, not since the unnerving times of the Arab nationalist revolutions of the 1950s have the monarchies of the Gulf so insecure, so threatened by this inexorable forces of revolutionary change. Saudi Arabia's panicky reaction to the tremors of change in Egypt, its frantic counterattack against anti-autocratic agitation in neighboring Bahrain, for example, shows this desperate attempt to stem the rising tide of popular demands. That's why the Saudi monarchy has tried to exploit ideological differences. It's stoking sectarian divisions. I mean, the Saudis are brandishing, as you know full well, the specter of Iranian mischief in fermenting this populist agitation and the rebellion in Sunni domains. Hence, the Saudis' venture to rally Sunni regimes in and outside the Middle East. This is nothing what we're seeing by Saudi Arabia, but a plotted shift from popular demands for democracy and a diversion into dangerous doctrinal infights. But ultimately, what these regimes are faced with are the same thing. Whether it's the Saudis or whether the King of Jordan or whether King Mohammed VI of Morocco, it's only the introduction of measured reforms that would save these regimes. That's why King Mohammed VI's speech, is important. I mean, he understood that unless he introduces reforms, the alternative for him, and also for the King of Jordan at this time, is really to watch change take place in the streets below with unpredictable consequences. So the same applies to the conservative monarchies of the Gulf, and any other Arab regimes. They can either opt for reform or they will continue their internal decay till they're swept away by the wind of change. That's why we have these different responses, I think, to the Arab Spring. And for now, as you rightly said, the Moroccan monarchy seems to have gone the farthest, the quickest, I think, to addressing some of the demands of the people in the street. Jordan is still hesitant, as we have seen King Abdullah's speech a few days ago, promising that future prime ministers will come from the ballot in conjunction with people's demands. And 2 days later, he comes back and he said, well, we might have to wait 2 to 3 years till we have a mature political system. I mean, this is the same game that autocrats have been playing for so long. So the challenge, I think, as I see it, is how to convince or frankly prevent this royalty club in the Gulf from becoming a reactionary bloc intent on defending the status quo. That's why there was a lot of concern about the invitation by the GCC as with the leadership of Saudi Arabia, for Morocco to join this club, and for Jordan, there is concern that they would put pressure, because it's common knowledge that the Saudis are concerned about what's happening in Morocco, because if Morocco's transition is successful into, you know, democracy, I mean, it's only a transition to democracy that the monarch has launched, but it's still important. If that succeeds, then that would present a powerful model for reform. Because what we have right now is just a republican model of reform in Egypt and Tunisia. But up to this date, there is no monarchical model. That's why what happened in Morocco, as I see it, is important. It's a step in the right direction.
Again, I'm speaking with Anwar Boukhars, who is a political science professor at McDaniel University and the author of Politics in Morocco, Executive Monarchy and Enlightened Authoritarianism. I guess what's happening then, you mentioned the Saudis' invitation to both Morocco and Jordan to join the GCC that they control. It's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, that the Hashemite king is being invited by Al Sauds in any way. And of course, the Al Sauds are trying to lean on the King Abdullah of Jordan not to reform. And I guess it's worth explaining to our audience the the relationship between the Al Sauds and the Hashemites.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the Hashemites, obviously, and the King Abdullah, I mean, and like in Morocco, I mean, King Abdullah has been pushing to get into the club, I mean, for years now. It's only the timing that really that is suspicious, I guess. I mean, he wanted a free trade agreement with the bloc. The bloc has not reacted, or at least has reacted hesitantly to that. But there are fears within Jordan of being dragged into two things, really, into a sectarian contest that is inimical to the process of democracy building, right? That's one. Though I need to make a distinction between Jordan and Morocco. The public reaction in Jordan was not as lukewarm or hostile to membership in the GCC as it was in Morocco. I mean, Jordan, we have to remember, it shares geographic proximity with the Gulf. It enjoys certain cultural and some tribal affinity with the bloc, and it really lacks a real sense of national identity. Jordanians also hope to benefit from the movement of labor, from discounted oil and financial aid. Morocco is different. That's why the reaction was really, I mean, one of derision.
They see it as a kind of an overt bribe, which is what it is, isn't it?
No doubt. I mean, you are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And that's why Jordanians are, especially in the urban part, and the, you know, Palestinian leanings, are wary of this sudden push to bring Jordan into the GCC fold. They're absolutely right. There is a concern that this is a reactionary move to preserve the current system with very few modifications.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I was alluding to, though, is that the Hashemite kingdom, of course, are, I suppose, the real pretenders to the descendants of Muhammad, right? And the Al Sauds are the custodians of the holy shrines, but they don't really have the lineage.
Though you can make the case, I mean, obviously, that the Saudis have more grounding and historical legitimacy than the Hashemites, in my view. I mean, true, the Hashemites, I mean, claim to that lineage, but, I mean, when you go back into history and see how the state was formed, it was formed by colonial design, and it doesn't have that reach into history that the Moroccan monarchy, for example, has, or even the Saudis do.
Sure. Well, we all know about the British and the French and drawing up the maps and the whole colonial legacy, which is we're dealing with now. And speaking of which, let's turn to Syria. What do you think is going to happen there? That's the different kind of despot, not the monarch, but he's not strictly a military dictator, but frankly he is. His brother, younger brother, runs the military and the secret police, and that's the glue that's holding the regime together, right?
I mean, you are absolutely right, and really, at first, and you are aware of this, there was that mistaken belief that the Syrian leadership at least enjoyed some legitimacy that others don't, that Mubarak, for example, didn't have any legitimacy, or even the King of Jordan in some respect. But that didn't work either way, because this is not mainly about foreign policy. This is not mainly about Israel treatment of the Palestinians, as you alluded to in the beginning. This is strictly about dignity. So Bashar, unfortunately, unlike the King of Morocco, for example, who have legitimacy, he has squandered whatever legitimacy he had. I mean, he had a choice, really, between two things. I mean, it's either reform or revolution. Unfortunately, as his speech demonstrated, it's just he has no interest to introduce credible reforms, and his legitimacy has been damaged, his credibility has been damaged anyway. So it's really a perilous journey. Whatever he does right now won't work out, because what would mollify, again, the people in the streets is radical reform, but he's not prepared to go that route, because that would mean the end of his regime. I mean, if you open up the political system, free elections, etc. Or what we're seeing in the streets. So neither steps are easy. But his legitimacy, as I said, is damaged. It's only a matter of time, I think, that he's gone. I think it's almost certain that Syria will look quite different in the next few years. I mean, he can still hold on, because what we are seeing is that there is not the defection in the military as of yet. Remember, the majority of the military, obviously, are made of conscripts, and those conscripts are of Sunni lineage. The one at the top, obviously, are Alawites, and we haven't seen any defection in there. But the question still remains, for how long can the regime... It's a battle of will, really, between the protesters. How long can they be able to mobilize people in the streets, and how long can the regime really keep, you know, his brutal forces in line? So as things unfold, and I guess as scholars of Syria obviously see it, it's only a matter of time before that regime crumble. Because experience tells us, and history really tells us, and theory also tells us, that regimes have lost their legitimacy. They cannot survive, and the legitimacy of the Syrian leader is totally spent.
Well, let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Anwar Boukhars, who is a political science professor at McDaniel University and is author of Politics in Morocco, Executive Monarchy and Enlightened Authoritarianism. And you were in Doha recently debating on television the Arab Spring. You were on the side that said the future was hopeful and that the revolutions will largely be successful. And I suppose then the Arab Spring will turn into the Arab Summer and not the Arab Winter. Now, the results are clearly mixed. What was your sense of the people you were debating? I mean, what is the rationale, given that this movement is so youth-driven? Syria, half the population is under 20. I believe it's similar in Saudi Arabia. We know that psychologically these kids have finished with these regimes. They just don't have the ability to get rid of them. What's the excuse for those people who think either pragmatically or they actually believe in authoritarianism? What was their argument?
Well, really, I mean, the other side who argued against this, it's not the belief in authoritarianism. It's just what they were arguing is just, I mean, this is going to be a long process. And in that, we don't disagree. I mean, really, for those who have hoped that Tunisia and Egypt, for example, they will make their transition quickly to democracy, and democracy would be consolidated, I mean, those people would likely be disappointed. I mean, the revolutions everywhere, they are just the beginning of a long process, and we're seeing that process play out in Egypt and even in Tunisia, which really has the most likelihood, I guess, to make its transition. But even then, we're seeing, you know, struggles about politics, about culture, about economics, but that's healthy.
One thing that's interesting about those struggles in Egypt is the divisions within the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not monolithic, and the liberals and the conservatives don't see eye to eye at all.
Well, you are absolutely right, and even in Tunisia, it's the same thing. I mean, look, the Muslim Brotherhood has never been monolithic, and Islamist movements, wherever they are, I mean, they're not monolithic. So what we're seeing the Muslim Brotherhood, and you're absolutely right, is that there is an intense debate, which is healthy, along generational and ideological lines, that is raging over the internal workings of the party and its stance regarding minority rights, women's role in politics. So it's fair to say that it's hard to predict which path the Brotherhood would travel and which faction will prevail. Mm-hmm. But I think that incorporating the movement in the political process will help facilitate, I mean, this political evolution. Because it's always been the case, only democratic debate, it's only the vigorous exchange of development of the most problematic Islamist theses, from an understanding of Sharia, for example, equality of women, freedom of conscience. So, and we're seeing that develop in this vibrant marketplace of ideas. That's one. So the Brotherhood will quickly learn the limits of ideological purity.
Just in the last minute then, we're running out of time. I wanted to get a wrap-up, though, on the real counter-revolutionary force, if you will, in terms of the Arab Spring, which is Saudi Arabia, this rigid monarchy that doesn't even allow a facsimile of a parliament and wants to be an absolute monarchy in turn. It's people into beggars, essentially.
Right.
Clearly, there's something seething under the surface, and that would be the biggest shoe to drop. And most people think, oh, it's never going to change. Well, I wouldn't be too sure. What's your feeling?
No, you're absolutely right. Again, it's only a matter of time. I mean, Saudi Arabia has used the power of the purse, as we know, to appease its own young and restless population. But it suffers really from the same ingredients of trouble that stirred revolutions elsewhere. I mean, even in Saudi Arabia, we talk about how wealthy the country is. Well, that wealth is not distributed equitably. I mean, there are over 40% unemployment. 40% for euro, you know, and unemployment. I mean, that's a major problem. Most of the people are young, as you said, and they're not divorced. They cannot be divorced from what's occurring elsewhere. Just look at, I mean, through Twitter and Facebook, Saudis' reactions, their enthusiastic response, obviously, to the historic revolts in Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere. So the monarchy still enjoys some legitimacy, but it's extremely vulnerable, A, because of the age of the leadership. I mean, if there is everybody's looking at succession. So if there is a crisis in succession, I mean, who knows what happens? We're seeing even women in Saudi Arabia are starting to challenge, the leadership for simple stuff like being able to drive. So you're right, something is festering. And unless the conservative monarchies, I mean, try to move ahead of the curve and try to address at least some of these demands, by and of the population would not do it. I mean, certainly not for so long. So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Anwar Bakaris. Thank you again.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you very much.
Anwar Bakaris is a political science professor at McDaniel University and is the author of Politics in Morocco, Executive Monarchy and Enlightened Authoritarianism. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the European debt crisis.
Don't